Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega of CNN. We turn now to the future of policing.
All right, what he's doing now, we call scrubbing the image, looking for clues as to where the murder is going to happen.
Original running bond brick pattern, streamline early Georgian details.
What are your prime directives?
Serve the public trust, protect the innocent, uphold the law.
The cybernetic oracle, the ultimate man-machine hybrid, programmed with every crime ever recorded and implanted with the brain cells of history's greatest detectives. We call him Pickles.
Okay, maybe we're not there yet, but we're actually a lot closer than you might think. Cutting-edge technology is changing the face of law enforcement. For example, police in some cities use data points about your life and your criminal history to predict whether or not you'll commit a crime. It's called big data policing, and it's happening now.
Big data policing is the use of new forms of predictive analytics, new forms of surveillance monitoring. That's changing the way police police. It's changing who they police. It's changing where they go on patrol. It's changing when they police. And in many cases, it's changing how they police.
That's law professor Andrew Ferguson. He's the author of a new book, The Rise of Big Data Policing.
Right now in patrol cars in Philadelphia and in L.A., police are now patrolling based on algorithms. And they take past crime data, sort of crunch it up into numbers, and they predict, they forecast where a particular crime will be at a particular time, and they send the police there, right? And some of the more sophisticated cars, literally as you drive from neighborhood to neighborhood, the screen changes in front of you, changes color in front of you. So you might go from like a blue, you know, aggravated assault neighborhood to a high theft area, and the little computer in front of you shifts from blue to green, so you know you're in a different area with a different particular crime. Problem. And so it's changing where police go.
So how do they know what type of data is being put into this algorithm? What's being fed into their system?
A lot of it is past crime data on the theory that some crimes are almost contagious, or some are somewhat viral, right? So burglary crimes tend to happen in sort of groups, right? If one house is burglarized, it's actually statistically more likely that other houses in that neighborhood are going to get burglarized. Same is true with car thefts and thefts from auto. Some of the more sophisticated models add in other factors. So, for example, they might add in weather when it rains. You know, bad guys don't like getting wet, so there's less robberies when it rains. All of these sort of inputs are added up into, you know, depending on the algorithm. Some are complex models and some are pretty simple models, honestly, and used to predict where crime may occur on the theory that if they get that right and they put the police officer at the right place at the right time, they could deter crime and they could reduce crime.
Now, the big question is, and I've talked to some law enforcement officials across the country who have varying opinions on this. Does it work?
We don't know. There are a handful, just a limited number of studies that have tried to evaluate it in the real world. And, you know, the jury's still out.
So there's the other example that you've talked about, which is the Chicago example and the heat maps that Chicago PD were using and then sending folks to people's homes based on that data?
So, you know, there's the place-based predictive policing, which is what I was just talking about, but there's also person-based predictive policing. And what Chicago is doing is they've created these heat lists, right? Individuals on a list of people who are the most or predicted to be the most at risk of violence. Either they're going to be the perpetrators or the victims of a violent crime. They are rank ordered, a score. You get a score. If you've been arrested in Chicago for the last 4 years, you have a heat list, a threat score from 1 to 500. And the people with the top scores, those 500 scores, on occasion get a knock on the door by a police administrator, usually accompanied with a social worker or someone from the neighborhood and someone from the community, to basically give a warning to that young person. Usually it's a young man. Usually it's a young man of color to say, look, we, the police, know that you are involved in this lifestyle. You have, you know, two paths ahead of you. One involves you being a victim of violence or being involved in violence. The other might involve getting out of this life and being involved in a, getting, you know, social services or the rest. And this is your choice. In fact, we have a letter. It's called a custom notification letter. It has your name on it. It has your prior record. It has everything we know about you. And what we're telling you now is that you're at risk. And if you don't shape up, we're going to bring the hammer down hard on you if you get in trouble again. And this is a quasi-public health approach in the sense of they're trying to identify people who are at risk. But of course, the problem with a public health approach is you got to actually have the components of social services and the rest, which you know, haven't really been funded to the way that I think many people wanted them to be funded.
I mean, let's be honest, though. Isn't that a bit invasive, patronizing?
Yes, I think it's a I think that if you can just imagine being that person, you're sitting in your apartment, something that's a knock on a door, and a police officer says, look, an algorithm has predicted that you're going to be more at risk. That is a measure of social control, honestly. It's a measure of surveillance. It's a measure of police sort of recognition that they're monitoring you. And it is threatening in many ways. There are literally people at your door telling you that you are now on this heat list. And I think that it is far more problematic than the place-based predictive policing, in part because the inputs that get you on this list involve, and this is the current standard, whether you have been arrested for a violent crime, a weapons crime, or narcotics, whether you've been the victim of a violent crime or an assault, your age at the last arrest, the younger the age, the higher the score, and sort of the trend line. Is this going up or down? Are you actually, you know, being more involved in crime or less? And the problem with that is when you have arrests as your input, you are necessarily also dealing with how police do their jobs. How do they use their discretion to arrest people? And if you have a city like Chicago, which in 2017, the, you know, DOJ Civil Rights Division went there, investigated, and found a systemic, problematic, you know, series of racial, you know, injustice, you know, both in terms of the structure and specific acts, you know that there's going to be a disproportionate bias in the outcome, right? So if your inputs have, you know, implicit and explicit bias, then your outputs are also made biased, and you're going to pretend that it's objective when it's really not. And that's a problem, right? That's a problem if you don't recognize the dangers in these data-driven targeting mechanisms.
So then the question becomes, where's the line? I mean, if I happen to live in a certain community that happens to be full of a certain type of person, I'm more likely to come in contact with folks like that, whether they have criminal histories or what have you. I mean, I grew up in a very low-income community, you know, so that likelihood is probably higher for me than it might be for other folks. And so where we draw the line hasn't really been demarcated yet in terms of our individual privacy.
No, not at all. In fact, the reason I wrote this book is I think that we have not, as a nation, been talking about this. We haven't recognized that these technologies are changing the way police are doing their jobs, of who's getting these systems or who's being collected in these databases. I view big data policing as both a civil rights issue because it affects different communities differently and affects communities of color differently in ways that we need to be paying attention. But it's also a democracy issue, right? We need to be starting to have these conversations and going to our chief of police and going to our mayors and saying, what surveillance are you using? What technologies are you using? How do you know they work? How do you know they're good? How do you know they're not, you know, creating or reifying some of the bias that we know exists in society? And we need answers because right now we don't have answers in almost every city in America about the technologies that are being used right now on our citizens.
Andrew Ferguson is the author of the new book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.